Welcome to Creating Sanctuary, a global interview series featuring 21 heroes who are saving animals' lives. I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and the hero that I'm interviewing today is Sandra Patey. She's the founder of the Donkey Sanctuary of Canada. Before she started the sanctuary, she was a high school teacher, she ran a small business, and was very involved with the Canadian Institute of International Affairs. Welcome, Sandra. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you.
So, Sandra, tell us what was the evolution of going from being a high school teacher and small business owner to starting a donkey sanctuary? How did it all begin?
Well, when I was in my early 40s, my husband and I and our children, we went to Davis, California, which, as you know, is outside Sacramento. And
very
we
close
were there,
to me.
Yes. And we were there for a year, and I went back to school, and that was the first year that I worked on my master's degree in anthropology. And over the course of that year, and when we came back in the year following that, we realized that the experience had been so formative and so important to us that one of the things that we knew for sure was that we wanted to move outside of the metropolitan Toronto, and we ended up buying a farm outside the city of Guelph, which is about an hour and a bit west of Toronto.
I know where it is. I've been to Guelph.
Living in the country and having gone back to school and having studied so many other cultures, other societies, I came to the conclusion that the interdependence of the world is, in fact, very profound, and that we as beings are all related to each other. My respect for the animal world rose considerably. Not that it rose considerably, but I became much more sensitive to the other animals, to their skills, their acumen, and to the fact that we as human beings, most of all, are just one more species on this planet.
Great.
So when we moved to the country, I had thought that I would like to take in some animals, and unexpectedly, we ended up having three donkeys come to the farm. From my first interaction with them, I realized that I had a kind of a comfort level and a kind of a, you could almost say, a kind of intuitive connection to them. I don't want to put any kind of a mystical sense to this. Rather, I just felt very comfortable with them.
Mm-hmm.
So the three donkeys lived at the farm, and life went on. And then I heard about another donkey that needed a home, and it was living in the back of a barn and had been sort of thrown into the back of the barn. And I ended up buying that donkey. I then heard about 12 donkeys that were on their way to auction. And as many people know, animal auctions are places where when an animal comes up for sale, if it isn't purchased by another buyer, it is then purchased by slaughterhouses, and they're slaughtered.
Mm.
I didn't want this to happen to the 9 donkeys, so I ended up negotiating for them, and I brought them to the farm. Well, we woke up, one of the donkeys had a foal, two of them had a foal, and I, you know, we had about 15 donkeys at the farm. About that time, I became aware of animal sanctuaries, and in particular in England, there is a very well-known sanctuary that's called the Donkey Sanctuary. That
is Ireland, right?
Well, Ireland is one of its branches, but the main sanctuary is in England. It's in southern England. But this organization has 10 farms, and they have taken in literally 9,000 donkeys over the years. They do international work in Africa and India and Mexico, helping animals. So when I was told about them, I contacted the founder, who has since died. She was a wonderful woman, Dr. Elizabeth Svensson. And I asked her in this very naive way, you know, what they were doing and how they were doing it. And she was very helpful, and she wrote me back, and she gave me some pointers, the most important in a way of which was, if you start a sanctuary and it's not for profit, you will spend virtually all of your time fundraising because animal care is so expensive. And that's one of the crucial things of sanctuaries, is that we are faced with the challenge not only of caring for the animals, but of having to raise the funds so that we can continue caring for the animals. That requires an enormous amount of time, and you have to be extremely well organized, and you have to establish a kind of tone, a kind of style, whatever that happens to be, and you have to generate a membership list and send out newsletters and be available to the public. Like, we are open on Sundays from the 1st of May until the end of October, and over the course of a year, we will have upwards of 25,000 people come to the farm. So there's that whole dimension, too. So I've gone off track, but at the same time, I hope that I've given some indication as to how this kind of came to be. So after I contacted Dr. Svensson, we realized that the first thing to be done was to get form a not-for-profit organization and then apply to the federal government to become a charity. Mm-hmm. You can be an animal charity in Canada so long as you demonstrate to the government that what you're doing is good for people. That's kind of a, like, I would love to be able to say that so that you can demonstrate that it's good for animals, but in fact,
right,
they will give you charitable status only if you're showing that it's good for people.
Uh-huh.
So we got our license, and we were caring for donkeys. We were taking in donkeys. For the first 5 or 6 years, longer than that, I'd say for the first 8 years, we were an extremely modest organization. When we opened on Sundays, we'd be thrilled if we had 50 people come. And even then, we thought that was really a lot. Things gradually increased. And then, fortunately, we were put into contact with an organization that's called World Animal Protection. And at the time, they were known as WSPA, which is the World Society for the Protection of Animals, but they changed their name 3 or 4 years ago. Anyway, WSPA had member charities, which they helped. And so they contacted us and asked us whether we would be interested, and we said, yes, we would. And what it meant was that they made available to us fundraising workshops and staff training workshops, and they were enormously helpful in our being able to develop a more sophisticated infrastructure. And so by the time we were 15 years old, this infrastructure was coming into place, and the number of animals we were taking in was more, and the number of people visiting in the education program, everything was kind of increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So this went on until 2012, when I retired, or no, 2013, and we then hired our first executive director. And that was a kind of a very significant step, because sanctuaries, as you come to know them, you'll see that too often they get started by a person or group, but when those people step back for whatever reason, very often the period of transition doesn't work out, and the organization ends up falling apart.
Right.
So that kind of a handover is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are today. Have I answered your question?
Yes, you did. So earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that there was kind of a shift inside of you from when you were a teacher and then your involvement in the Canadian Institute of International Affairs. Tell me about that
and
shift
going
inside
back to
of
school.
You. And
right.
going back to school.
And going back to school was crucial.
Yeah. That made you love, that made you want to work more for animal rights or animal protection.
Right. Well, the anthropology helped me to solidify a worldview. I came to, really what I came to do was to respect the other animals on this globe. Until those years when I was in my late 20s and 30s and 40s, early 40s, I could often be heard saying, oh, I just love animals. I just love dogs. I love cats. Whatever. But loving the animals, I came to understand, wasn't the term that was required. What was required was that I should respect them for their unique skills, for their ways of living, and in the process, I came to accept the fact that I was no more than they are.
Right.
I am. We are all on the same sort of level playing field.
Right.
It so happens that human beings, thanks to the fact that we have a thumb and a forefinger, and because we can speak to each other like we do, we have managed to overtake most of this world.
Right.
But that's not necessarily where it should be. So when I, as I considered my place in the world and the animals' places vis-a-vis the animals, I saw them in an entirely different light. And so that as a result to this day when I'm talking with people or people are talking to me, I always want to encourage them to look at the other animals as being worthy of their respect and not this kind of throwaway line, I love them.
Right.
Because when you say I love them, you aren't necessarily putting them up to a level that I think they deserve.
Yeah, that's what I say too, is that, you know, my goal is to help people understand that all beings on this planet have an intelligence of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't necessarily understand how they are intelligent or their intelligence. Like, how does a colony of ants work? It's miraculous when you think about it, when you look at it.
Yes.
Right? And they all have their own intelligence and are worthy of our respect.
That's right. And I think too, something else when you ask about my changing attitude or my evolving attitude, I was raised in the Roman Catholic Church by a very conservative mother. And in so doing, as with most conservative Orthodox religions, the view that was given was of a universe where there is God on top, and then the angels, and then man, and then woman, and then children, and then the animals, according to the way they could walk or fly. All right. When you carry that kind of cosmology around in your mind, it can almost be taken for granted that you won't have the same feelings, the same respect for those underneath you. And you will think that those above you are better or stronger or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this cosmology that prompted my mother to tell me, and that the Catholic Church still maintains, that animals have no souls. And since animals have no souls, therefore they are inferior.
It's amazing how that religious point of view has infiltrated And I think even if people aren't necessarily Catholic or weren't raised Catholic, they still, most of them, still have that opinion that the animals were put here for us eat, to do with what we will, right?
Yes.
As our servants.
And one of the other results of these assumptions is in North America, in most of the world, any parts of our criminal codes that deal with crimes against animals, the assumption in those clauses is that animals are property. Mm-hmm. And as property, you can do whatever you want with your property because mm-hmm. you own it. It is not so that animal welfare groups in recent decades have been lobbying governments, working hard. They're making slow progress to have governments change their criminal codes to include the assumption that animals are sentient beings. And mm-hmm. as sentient beings, they can feel, they can feel pain, most of all. So the United Nations, I forget how many years ago, 10 years ago or something like that, brought out one of its policies in which they recognize animals as being sentient beings. That's the case now in the Netherlands, I think. Did you know that in the Netherlands they have an animal police force?
No, I didn't.
They do.
That's wonderful.
It is wonderful. It is wonderful. Google it. And it's,
I will.
It's been operating since 2010. And the only reason that it was allowed to exist was that in the Netherlands they have representational democracy, and very often their governments are formed by coalitions of various mm-hmm. parties. And in 2010, the one particular coalition that was formed had a party in it that was very much for animal rights. And they were able to make the deal that they would support the government if the government introduced this animal police. So there
That's
are
fantastic.
I know. So there are 245 officers in the Netherlands, specially trained, who do nothing but animal matters. And then there are many hundred other officers who are involved with other things, but they've had the training.
That is amazing. So natural question for me follows from that, which is, what about the animals that are going to slaughter? Do farm animals have the same rights there? Or do, because
that is just such a
huge part of the cruelty.
Right. Well, that's the line of division between animal welfare and animal rights. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, the Donkey Sanctuary of Canada is an animal welfare organization.
Mm-hmm.
And World Animal Protection is an animal welfare organization, whereas PETA is an animal rights organization. And so the animal rights people, as I understand it, maintain that all animals have the same right to live and should not be available for to be eaten or, you know, anything else like that. Whereas mm-hmm. animal welfare, we believe that the important thing is the quality of the animal's life.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so consequently, we disagree with all of the industrial farming practices and are, you know, working towards better animal care in that way. But do we go so far as to say that animal slaughter is wrong? No, animal welfare doesn't.
But the way the animals are treated, even if they are going to eventually go to slaughter, is what matters to you. So
yes. Yes.
So you wouldn't find hundreds or thousands of chickens in a small room.
Acceptable. No.
Acceptable.
No.
Yeah.
So there's also an organization that's not all that well known that I think they're doing rather good work. It's called the Humane Farming Association,
mm-hmm.
and they're located in California, I think. They have a big farm, like a sanctuary farm.
I will look them up.
Okay.
Thank you. That's a wonderful history. And so you've written a book, and I think you said that your book covers part of this evolution in thinking. Is that right?
Yes, it does. And then the other part of the book is concerned with specific donkeys that have impacted upon my life, who have moved into the category for me of being unforgettable for all kinds of reasons. When I was involved with the sanctuary, you know, day in and day out, you can develop all kind, such a different relationship with the animals than when you only see them, well, not every now and then. What happened was the Donkey Sanctuary of Canada was able to buy the farm from my husband and me so the animals would have a permanent home. The farmhouse where we lived has become offices and a residence for the sanctuary's farm manager. And we built a house right next door to the sanctuary. So I get to go up there every day, but I'm not involved with the running.
Would
and the
you
sanctuary.
Mind sharing? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Would
okay.
you mind sharing a story of one of the special donkeys that impacted you?
Oh, my goodness.
You?
Well, I could tell you. Because there's so many. Who will I choose? Okay. I'll tell you about Alice. Alice was born, or Alice lived with an old gentleman, an older gentleman, about 25 miles away from us. And he contacted us, and this was early on in the sanctuary. We'd only been open a year or so. And he said, I've got this donkey, she lives with me, and he said, I'm getting old and I don't think I can take care of her anymore. So we went to his house, and he had a very small house in the country outside a small town, and there was kind of a ramshackle little barn there, and that's where Alice lived. And Alice, otherwise, the farm, which was, I don't know, 2 or 3 acres, was all fenced, and Alice used to walk around all over, and they had a very nice life. But he decided that he couldn't care for her anymore. So we brought Alice to the sanctuary. And from the beginning, she was not interested in living with the main herd. She just didn't get on with them. She liked to stand in the barnyard under some of the fir trees, and she would just kind of stand there with her ears lowered a bit, sleeping. Well, one day we had a tour of students who were handicapped. They had special needs. And there were 8 or 9 of them in this tour. And they were young people who, several of them were autistic. And I say that because they were walking around and experiencing everything, but doing so very much on their own terms. So Alice was in the barn at this point. Or Alice had been in the yard, and some of the children had gone up and walked up and patted her and everything like that. And then, as she was inclined to do, she just gradually eased away when she'd had enough. And she went into the barn. She had a corner of the barn. We still have Alice's portrait painted there, where she would stand and sleep. And so I was busy with the group, but at one point went into the barn. And there was Alice standing there. And when she rested, her big ears would kind of flop down a bit to the side. And as I walked into the barn, I saw this little boy who was, oh, I don't know, maybe he was 8 or 9 years old, but he was tall enough that he had been able to flop over Alice's back. And she was standing there with her ears down, not moving, and he was humming. And he just kind of hummed for a while. And I stood and watched them for at least 4 or 5 minutes. And then I realized that there were other people who were standing watching them too. And then the little boy, he was finished, and he sort of got up and walked away. And Alice just sort of wandered off. There's the story about Alice.
Her connection with that boy.
Yeah. Wow. It was marvelous. It was marvelous.
Oh, I believe it. So on your sanctuary, you have a very involved foster farm program.
Yes.
Can you tell us how that works and how you went about setting that up?
Once again, that was an example of a way that I learned about this when I was in touch with England. I ended up going to England, David, my husband and I ended up going to England there and 1998, and we started the sanctuary in 1992. But they had a well-established foster farming program, and we modeled ours after it. So with our foster farming program, there are on the website, there are all the terms and all of the conditions. We see the foster farm program as a learning possibility because we have very particular standards of care. And we don't accept people to be foster farmers for the Donkey Sanctuary of Canada unless they're willing to meet our standards of care. The animals are placed in pairs, and they're placed on a kind of a long-term loan. But if, for any reason, the family moves, they want to stop taking care of the animals become sick with something very sick, the animals come back to us. So we don't put them out in the foster farms and then say bye-bye. They're still very much part of the DSC. So currently we have 23 foster farms, 22 foster farms, and we have 44 donkeys out of them. And we have a few foster farms that, you know, they've been going for years and years and years and years. Our first foster farm started in 1998. And in most, I think I can say this, in the majority of situations, the animals have been at these foster farms for like 10 years. And then something happens and they come back to us. Oh, we have field officers also who visit the farms once a year, if not twice. And that gives the farmers, the family, a chance to ask questions about care, or we make suggestions or whatever, or if there's a situation that is a concern, then we look into that. But the last question that our people ask the family every time they visit is, do you still want to take care of these donkeys?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, years go by, things happen. Mm-hmm. So that's the foster farm program. It's very expensive for us because most of the farms, I think all of the farms, are in Ontario. Or actually, we have one foster farm. They were in Ontario, and then the family, one of the members of the family, Paula Pick, she became the chairman of the board of the Donkey Sanctuary. So we have had a very close relationship with Paula and Laura for 20-odd years. Anyway, they moved out to BC, and they said, Sandra, could we take our foster donkeys with us? And they're such an amazing place. So they moved out to the Nicola Valley in BC, where they bought a part of a ranch, and they have 265 acres. That's linked to this spread that is all fenced, that is like 1,000 acres. And they have four donkeys. And in the Nicola Valley, it is a very arid climate. It's very much like Arizona, which is a natural habitat for donkeys. So their four donkeys live on this beautiful farm or ranch. They roam around. They come back to the barn, usually every night out of choice. And they just... They have perfect hooves. They have the greatest life. So that's a very unusual foster farm. The other ones are all in Ontario, but Ontario is a very large province. So our staff spend a lot of time driving.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And do you also cover medical expenses and food for them, or do they?
What has evolved is that the foster farm families take care of the regular vet and farrier expenses. But if an animal becomes very sick, then we step in.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, equine care, it can run into the thousands without, you know, within the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Sandra, one last question for you, unless there's anything else you want to add. What is an average day at the sanctuary for you or for someone who's actively involved?
Well, I'll just tell you some of the things that are going on in an average day.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, currently we have, I think my number's right, we have 85 donkeys living at the farm and 11 or 12 mules and some goats. So we have animal care staff. There will be two, if not three, animal care staff on any given day. The donkeys that live in the barnyard, and that would be up to 20 of them, we just call that area the barnyard. They're the older animals or special needs animals, and they have special diets, and so staff's busy in the morning taking care of that. Then they're putting out hay for the mules. The farriers, we have two farriers, and they come one day a week because every equine's hooves are trimmed, I think it's once every 6 weeks, once every 8 weeks. The main herds of donkeys are in the donkey house, which we were able to build in 2010. And so up there, they are separated into three herds. We have the geldings in one herd, and most of the jennies and the less active geldings are in another herd, and then we have another herd of minis. So there, the staff is involved with cleaning out that area. We have usually on any given day, there'll be one volunteer, if not more, there too, helping. Our volunteers do a tremendous job, and I think that that's something that I haven't talked about, is our volunteers have been just wonderfully helpful over the years. Certainly when we started, I couldn't have possibly functioned without them. And our staff, our animal care staff, is outstanding. So that's going on in the barnyard and in the donkey house and in the mules' paddocks. And the animals have access to very large fields where they can graze. But their grazing is watched carefully because donkeys' bodies metabolize food very efficiently and they convert it into sugar very, very easily. Mm-hmm. So in order to offset the development of abscesses, we make sure that the animals graze under very controlled circumstances. Some staff at some point during the day will be involved with animal training. And then, meanwhile, up at the house in the offices, there's the executive director, there's our events communications manager, our stewardship manager, and our office manager. They're all working up there, doing the processing of donations and organizing events and whatever. We have the Long Ears Boutique that's open on open days, and we have a retail manager for that. She does an amazing job. Wait till you see it. It's the most gorgeous boutique.
I can't wait.
And then our vet, she comes in once a week too. And
okay.
She'll be involved with either dental work or maybe the odd abscess, or we have many older animals who have all kinds of issues, really. We have one mule, Danny Boy, who's been with us. Danny's almost 30 now. And for the past 5 years anyway, he's just been full of cancer. But he just goes on and on. He's not in pain. Mm. And he eats well and lives very quietly. But when I say full of cancer, I mean he has tumors. But he's doing very well, and he's watched very closely and ambles around and just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a general.
That painted a very nice picture for me.
Oh.
How do you know if a donkey is in pain?
Well, that's one of the challenges for the staff, because donkeys have a very high tolerance level when it comes to pain. Horses will show pain long before a donkey does. So staff do an incredible job of it. They know the animal so well, and you know, like sometimes I will go down to the old barn, which is where the tack room is, and I'll notice that such and such a donkey has been moved out of the herd at the donkey house, and they're in the barnyard, and I ask why. Well, she just was walking kind of slowly. We're just kind of worried about her hooves.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring her down, mm-hmm. and they watch her carefully, and they check her, and so on and so forth. It's much of it is looking at the animals, reading their body language.
Mm-hmm.
That's something else we like to encourage, especially with young people coming to the farm, is encouraging them to understand that all animals have their unique body languages. And the more that we can read those languages, then the more that we can understand them and they can understand us. And we try to show them how the donkeys are always watching us. And they're always watching all of our bodies and what all of the movements are that we're making. Humans,
mm-hmm.
you know, tend to take that for granted, that it's
mm-hmm.
that it just happens.
And they're quietly observing us,
yes.
and studying us.
Yes.
Wow, wonderful. Sandra Patey, I so look forward to our visit. We've scheduled a visit for next month, and I'm
yes.
so excited. I'm going to be bringing my auntie, or she's going to be bringing me, because I'm going up to Guelph to visit.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And Yes, and I so look forward to meeting you in person. So thank you for your time today. Yes. And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and I want to encourage them to go to your website at thedonkeysanctuary.ca. That's for Canada, right? Thedonkeysanctuary.ca.
Yes.
And you've been listening to Creating Sanctuary for Animals, and I'm your host, Yolanda Calderon, and I look forward to talking to you all again soon. Bye-bye.